Hi, I'm Len Epp from Lean Pub, and in this episode of the Lean Pub podcast, I'll be interviewing Gareth Holbrook. Based in Auckland, Gareth works with executives, senior engineers, and coaches on the governance of sustained performance. A former Royal Navy engineer and agile transformation specialist, he has led teams at Visa and partnered with L. David Marquette on intent-based leadership. His work addresses the gap between committing to difficult outcomes and maintaining coherence under pressure without drifting into burnout. He has competed in dozens of ultra endurance events, including the Ironman World Championship in Hawaii and the Kiwiman Double Extreme Triathlon. The discipline required to persist without breaking translates directly to leadership, engineering, and organizational change, as Gareth says in his profile description. You can follow him on LinkedIn at Gareth Holbrook and check out his Substack at Gareth Holbrook. Gareth is the author of the book, Ishi, the Discipline of Determined Intent. In the book, Gareth presents the Ishi spiral, a four-phase discipline that governs how intent is set, how practice is structured, when persistence is justified, and how reflection prevents drift before collapse forces correction. The four phases, decide, forge, persist, and reflect, are working concepts tested under real load, not theory assembled at a distance. The problem is structured, not motivational, as Gareth says in the description. People push through fatigue because stopping feels weak, or abandon work before effort compounds because discomfort gets misread as misalignment. Both patterns destroy capacity. Both emerge from the same failure, the absence of a mechanism to distinguish endurance from self-harm while choice still matters. In this interview, we're going to talk about Gareth's background and career and his interests and his book. And at the end, we'll talk a little bit about his experience as a writer. And in particular, perhaps along the way the book itself was written in accordance with what it presents to you as the reader. So thank you very much, Gareth, for being on the Lean Pub podcast.
Thank you, Len. It's a pleasure to be here.
I always like to start these interviews by asking people for their origin story. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about where you grew up and how you made your way into the career that you've built for yourself in leadership.
Yep. So as you can tell from my accent, although I live in New Zealand now, I was born in Manchester in England. And as an 18-year-old, I joined the Royal Navy. It was something as a teenager I just wanted to do all the time. My brother was already in the Navy, but I was really interested in the leadership part of it to become a naval officer. I didn't quite get through the interview process, so I went as an engineer instead, an engineering apprenticeship, and spent 5 years in the Navy. And during that time, I spent some time at sea in the Mediterranean and the North Atlantic, and learnt about discipline and how the military operate. Leaving the Navy because of redundancy in 94, I then got into manufacturing, ended up working at Sony, which was alongside really my fascination with Japanese philosophy. I'd practiced karate as a teenager, and working at Sony, firstly, it kind of popped the bubble because I thought it was going to be a high performance area of excellence. But we know that Sony was at its pinnacle in the 1990s, and it's kind of tailed off since then. Gillian spoke about the silo effect, and Sony in particular, and I experienced it firsthand. So I was a little bit disappointed, but I did learn about Japanese management, how Japanese manufacturing works, and I'd studied Toyota. Then in 2000, lifelong ambition, come and live in New Zealand. It was only going to be for 2 years. And then I was going to try Canada or Australia, move around a bit. But I kind of settled there and stayed here. So it's been 26 years now. And it was another small company I started at, a tech company called Navman. I was a project manager for GPS navigators, chart plotters, GPS in general. And again, we were using Kanban. It was a lean manufacturing line. The chief ops officer worked at Alpine, so he knew lots about Japan. And so from Navman, I set up, after 5 years there, I really wanted to set up my own startup, and I had a biohacking tech startup in altitude training. And this aligned to something else that was emerging in my life at the time, which was ultra endurance racing. So I said to myself, the first year in Auckland, I'm going to run a marathon. And I ran the Auckland Marathon in 2000. And then I just started doing longer races, got into triathlon. And by 2003, 2004, I started doing the half Ironman distance. And at the same time, I set up this altitude training company to coach and train athletes to get excellence. Those, you know, a few percent here and there makes a big difference on a long day. And so I had this tech startup, really proud of myself, wanted to try my own technology, but also sell this biohacking service. Didn't go well. Within 6 months, it was obvious that I was never going to make it commercially successful, but I just ground on for 5 years, lost my shirt, lost everything, trying to keep it working, trying to keep it running. And in the end, after the GFC in 2008, 2009, I wound up the business elegantly and went back into employment as a project manager. And it was around that time I learned about agile coaching. So I started working with software companies in agile coaching and read about Scrum. And this made perfect sense to me because Scrum is based on Nonaka and Takeuchi and Japanese model of working. And I understood lean thinking as well, which does inform lots of Scrum. John Boyd, sorry, OODA Loop, and Jeff Sutherland, who learned about Boyd. So I became a Scrum Master. And then for the last 15 years, I've been a coach and a Scrum Master and then an Agile Practice Lead at Visa. And then 2020, I left Visa for one job, one reason, and that was to race in the Ironman World Championships at the end of 2020. At the same time, I connected with David Marquet. I'd met him a few years before, and I started offering up leadership coaching to execs, working alongside him with intent-based leadership. So I've been working with David ever since. And along the way, I've accrued over 30 ultra-distance races, mainly Ironman, but all distances all over the world, including the Kiwiman, which is in New Zealand. It's an X-Tri. And I did the double, which is 2 days back to back. So around about 2020, I thought, I could really write a book about this. And that's when I signed up to Lean Pub. And it's taken me a few years to finally get the book done. The World Champs didn't happen in 2020, it happened in 2022. And then the last few years, I've just been finishing off the book, which is now live and published on Lean Pub.
Thank you very much for sharing all of that. I've got a couple before we go on to talk about the book and maybe the experience you had at the Ironman that sort of you lead the book off with. One thing I've had guests on the podcast of various vintages and who've some of whom have served in the military in various capacities. I don't think I've ever spoken with someone who was an engineer in the Royal Navy. What was it like on the what did you do in a typical day if you can sort of like narrow it down to a soundbite as an engineer?
Weapons engineer. So you have all the weapon systems. I was an apprentice when I was at sea. And basically, they wanted me to go around every department because the next time I'd be at sea, I would have been a petty officer on board a submarine. But I needed to know how the radars work, the sonar, the gunnery systems, all of the sensors. And I specialized in electronic warfare, communications and electronic warfare. So the SATCOMs, the sneaky, spooky stuff. And so what on a daily basis, I served off the coast of the Adriatic, off the coast of Yugoslavia during that war, and I just happened that month to be on the close weapon system. So I was every day we'd have to strip down the guns, re-grease them, test fire them, check them again, and reassemble them. But a lot of the time it was just scheduled maintenance, watch keeping, as a junior rate. But had I gone back to sea, I would have led a department, so they were training me to be able to be the expert in a single weapon system. Probably on a submarine, that would have been the comms and the periscope.
And were you like, just for color, were you like sleeping in bunks like one might see in the movies if one's never been on like a kind of real kind of Navy ship like I haven't?
So I did spend a week on board HMS Splendid, which was a hunter killer submarine, and they
Oh,
didn't have
okay.
any beds. They
Right.
have, so we hot bunk. So at any one time, half the crew are on watch and the other half are sleeping. And we rotate around 6 hours, 6 hours. And so we hot bed, so we share the same bed. That's why it's hot bed. But for me, they didn't have a bed because they only had a crew of 150, I think it was 130. So they had little bunks that were between the torpedo launches. And so I slept between the torpedoes. It was very cramped. I'm not exceptionally tall, I'm only 6 feet. But even so, I was having to duck through the gangways and careful not to knock my head. So it's a short man's service. It's not a tall person's service.
And I can imagine just the discipline that it would take to kind of keep your head right, being underwater and for days and or weeks at a time.
Yeah, so I never did prolonged service. My brother did. He was in the Navy for 27 years, and he served on the Trafalgar class subs for 18 years of that. And yes, you would be away for sometimes 7 months. You would be submerged for weeks on end sometimes doing certain operations. But you know, the thing about the Navy I really like, and it does feed through to my book, is everything that we did from torpedo loading to refueling at sea, even to loading the food stores, would be an evolution, it's called, and it would be a practice that you would have. It would be written down, but you'd have to practice again and again. So every single day on board that ship, we would have a fire exercise. So on HMS Beaver, I was one of the firefighters, one of the fire party, and every day we'd have to do a fire exercise. And the reason is, when it happens for real, you needed it in your muscle memory. It needs to be second nature. And that's what the military do with military precision.
The next thing I wanted to ask you about, just sort of going through your LinkedIn here, is you spent some years studying at the Open University, I
Yeah.
believe. Yeah. And what were you
Yeah, I did.
studying?
So the Navy gave me an apprenticeship in engineering, so a trade apprenticeship, and then like the first year degree level. And then I left the Navy, and I wanted to become a graduate, so I studied innovation and product development, IT and comms, coding, software, electronics, all that good stuff. And carried that through. Even when I came to New Zealand, I was still remote studying back to England, and then had to fly back to the UK for summer school two or three times before I finished it in, I think, 2002.
Okay. Just for anyone listening or watching, if you're not from the UK and you've never heard of the Open University, look it up. This is a fascinating institution with a fascinating purpose and history.
I think it's unique worldwide. I don't know anyone else who does it.
No,
But yeah,
yeah.
it was good for me. I mean, I had a full-time job, and I was kind of studying at night after the job. But that was the kind of person I am. I just always had a role and something, a target to aim for.
Well, actually, that leads me to the next question I wanted to ask you before we move on to talk about your book. So, you talk about, one's nature leads one in various directions. Yours led you to be quite independent for a while, and you stuck with the startup. But then you went back to working for companies. What was that like for you to kind of go back?
It was humiliating, I'll be honest. There's nothing wrong with being an employee, but I'd kind of set myself out and created a persona, and my identity was, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm going to run my own business, and it's going to be great. And I had six employees, and but then it got to the point I couldn't even make payroll, so I was then having to contract as a project manager just to pay for the first company, so the second company paying for the first. It was terrible. But then going back to employment is, you kind of accept it. It was, I tried, it didn't work, let's move on, see what I can do next. But that was 2008, so it was about the time I got married to my wife. At the same time, she was keen that I wasn't a homeless entrepreneur. So I think by 2012, I'd done a few years as a full-time employee, and I went back to being a solopreneur, consultant, contractor. So since 2011, 2012, I've been kind of running my own business again.
I've spoken to many authors who kind of follow various arcs, and that's one of them, from maybe even being something kind of very rigorous and hierarchical, like the military, to something in companies, to something independent, back to companies, back to something independent. And it does seem like people, there's a that you can it's easy to say it with hindsight, but there is a kind of personality guiding the progress often.
And I think if I reflect on the companies I've enjoyed the most, are the small startup companies, where I've been in like 1 or 2 degrees separation from the founder. So Navman was Sir Peter Mair, and it was a huge company in New Zealand at the time. And the visa company, actually, I joined a company called Freedom, and I was reporting directly to the CIO, Simon, who was a founder. But on the day after I joined, they announced they'd been acquired by Visa. And Visa, Sony, and I've worked with some of the bigger banks in New Zealand. The decision making in larger companies slows down, and the autonomy slows down. And I understand why. It's because of standardization, because you can't have divergence on larger companies. But I like the fast pace of a small startup, and I've always enjoyed the smaller tech companies. So the last one I consulted at, Foster Moore, a year or so ago, I worked for Joel Foster, and it was only 200 or 300 employees there. But I was working at the C-suite, so supporting the exec team. But I was also working at the team level, so I was coaching teams as well. So because it's small, you can do a vertical slice across the whole organization. It's not as easy to do if there's like 5,000 people there.
Definitely, definitely, definitely. And so then you told the story that you moved into kind of independent consulting and things like that, and combined with your sort of growing experience with Ironman racing. And so the book begins with a story about you collapsing near the end of a race, very movingly told. And I was wondering if you could, just take a few minutes to tell that story and why it's so important that it sort of became the kind of opening part of the book.
So the idea of Iron Man, and you may have what read Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins, and 5 years ago I'd read it. A fantastic idea that you need persistence, you need grit, and you need to be hard. Angela Duckworth's Grit, brilliant book. And that was in my mind. And when I do Ironman, so I've done one similar race per year at least for the last 22 years now. And it's always to set myself the challenge. And it's hard, right? Obviously, it's hard. You get to the 25-kilometer mark, or 20 miles into a 26-mile marathon, you hit the wall. It always hurts. Things start to chafe, muscles start to cramp up. But then you have to press on and you have to overcome and just say, well, this is it's a signal, it's a pain, accept it, move on, and you can't give up. And I like the idea of being tenacious and stubborn, and it got me through some of the few more recent races, or the earlier races. But then I went to Hawaii and I spent the whole of 2022 training just for this race, and I flew out to Hawaii a month before, so I could acclimatize because it's quite hot. And August in New Zealand, Southern Hemisphere, so it's the winter, not good to acclimatize. So that's not a cheap thing to do. And I'd thrown absolutely everything at it. I had a coach, one of the top coaches in the world, actually, a nutrition plan, training volumes, everything was on point. And even down to the jockey wheel of the gear shifter. I swapped out to make it a ceramic version, which was a few hundred dollars because it gave me an extra watt of power. I was throwing everything at it because I wanted this to be my pinnacle race. And the timing I wanted was 11 hours 20. And that reason was David Goggins did Kona in 11 hours 21. And I thought, well, at least if I beat Goggins, that's a good time. I'd never win it. I'm not a professional and I'm a bit older now. The professionals do it in 7 to 8 hours. And I'm never going to be near that. But I thought I'll be the best I can be, especially for a 50-year-old. So perfect. I had a great swim. I get seasick, believe it or not, in the swim, ex-Navy, go figure. But I had a good swim, faster than I was expecting. Got on the bike and was conservative, was disciplined, restrained myself, carried on, didn't get excited overtaking people. Taking my nutrition, that's really important to take the carbohydrates and the fluids on a consistent basis, because otherwise you'll pay for it later on. But one thing, my coach the week before gave me a spreadsheet and he said, how much carbs, when are you having the gels, all of the different things, when are you going to drink, all the way through. And he had a column for sodium. Now, I know Hawaii hot, when you sweat, you lose salt. So I knew you needed sodium. Of course you do. You get a bit in the gels, the Gatorade on the course, you'll get a bit of salt, but not a lot. So I had salt tablets, and I put them in a little box on the frame of the bike. So every half hour or so, I can take a gram, maybe a gram and a half an hour, something like that. But I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do. I was going to do a sweat test at the expo, all that kind of stuff. And it was the kind of thing that I left off. Everything else perfect. But that really caught up with me because on the bike, there was a huge crosswind and I couldn't reach in and take the tablets, and sometimes I lost the tablets. And then later in the marathon, I hadn't taken enough salt. So I got to about 25 kilometers and it started to struggle. You can see on my Garmin, the pace started to taper off a bit. And then I got to 35 kilometers and I collapsed. I lost consciousness and I was on the floor for 40 minutes. And I was suffering from hypernatremia, which is an absence of salt, and this is really, really, really serious. It has killed people. The Boston Marathon, strangely, is one that catches people, because especially the slower runners tend to drink too much water, which dilutes the salt, But in Hawaii, it's because you sweat so much, you lose the salt. So I was on the floor, and the docs came, and there was somebody else down just behind me. So the doctor said, "Well, I'll go to see this other person, athletes around me." And I was pulling out. My wife is a doctor at the finish line. I said, "Radio to my wife, I'm fine, but I'm pulling out. That's it, it's over." So this was 18 years of me trying to get to this one chance to get to Hawaii, and it was over with 7K to go, which you could walk in an hour easy. So yeah, I was quite upset about that. Then as the doctor went away, one of the sponsors, and they're now the naming sponsor for Ironman, he came up and said, "How much salt have you been having?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, a gram an hour." And I looked in the back of my suit and I still had like five or six tablets there. So obviously I hadn't been taking them. And he said, "You're just out of salt." So he gave me a bottle of water, half a liter of water, with an effervescent tablet of salt. He said, "Drink, get that down you. That'll make you feel better." Within 5 or 10 minutes, a doctor had come back and he said, "Right, okay, I'm going to sign you off. We'll get you in the ambulance, get you on an IV." And I said, "Actually, I'm stood up now. I'm feeling quite okay. If maybe I just walk to the next aid station, get some food there, and then I'll pull out there, or maybe I'll run to the next aid station." And so I walked, then I ran, and then I actually finished the race. Mike Riley said, "Gareth Holbrook, you are an Ironman." I did it, 13 hours and 16, so 2 hours slower than I should have been. Now, Triathlon New Zealand picked up on this and put it in the newsletter saying, "What a hero. It's great. Ironman's hard. Gareth collapsed, but he still finished." For a few years, I dined out on that. I'm unstoppable. Even when I get hyponatremia, I still finish the race. Isn't that great? But writing this book, I thought about it. And there's a pattern there, which I can draw back throughout my life, is that I'm sometimes so fixated on that goal that I become blinkered. And I've been told this as well. And because I'm blinkered, I overreach, I burn out. And there's a few cases throughout my triathlon career where I've gone too far and it's been dangerous. And this was a case when it was dangerous. So the essence of the book, and that's why that I lead with this story, is yes, we need to persist. But on the other hand, we need to know how to exit and when it's not safe to continue, when conditions change. Or in between, what can you adjust to carry on? So that was the first chapter of the book.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much for sharing that. It's very interesting. I wasn't expecting to draw this connection, but the idea that you said about like doing evolutions in military training and being able to kind of operate based on your training when when the situation gets tense or dangerous even is actually a really important part of what you're talking about as well, right? And that's one of the reasons to have a kind of something like the issue spiral or something like that to kind of draw upon that you develop over time is so important for, leadership and facing challenges.
Yeah, because in the moment, those small mistakes happen all of the time. There was a race in Germany this weekend, and the lady who came second, Lucy Charles Barclay, she came second the year I raced as well, actually, and she's a one of the top performers around the world. Now she collapsed 6 months ago or 9 months ago. Now last October, she collapsed and had to pull out because of the same thing as me. The heat just got her in the energy lab. But the reason I raise Lucy is she's a pro. She's been on the podium dozens of times. And in Germany, she went into the transition with the bike to get onto the bike. And she pulled off the bike and set off and went, "Oh, I forgot my helmet." She had to go back, put a helmet on. And you can get a penalty for that, right? You can get a 5 minute stand down for that, I think it is.
Right.
But that's the simplest, silliest thing. Now, Lucy knows you got to wear a helmet, she knows the rules. But when you're in the moment, those little minor details are the difference between being successful or something catastrophic.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so to get into the book, the book has a very kind of deliberate structure. And so I was wondering if you could talk. Well, first we'll talk about part one, and then we'll talk about part two, and then we'll get to the issue spiral. So just for people listening, we will be getting there in just a couple of minutes. But the structure is very deliberate. And part one is called Intent Under Pressure. And can you talk a little bit about what that is?
So I believe that one of the challenges that we have is we may have a desire or a goal, and we say, for example, it's New Year's Day, I'm going to lose weight this year, or I'm going to go to the gym. And we know that from Strava, the data shows that the second Friday of January, there's a cliff edge when people stop going to the gym. So we all have good intentions, and this isn't a judge of character, it's an observation of environments. What happens is we get overwhelmed with competing demands for our time. We also sometimes don't make conscious decisions. So I guess very few people make a conscious decision to doom scroll for 2 hours, yet we all get sucked into it. And that's because algorithms, habit, peer pressure, social norms, all of these things cause us to follow action which isn't intentional. So I think that the failure of intentionality and the problem that we're facing is how we govern ourselves. If we're going to make a decision, we're saying yes to something, we therefore necessarily have to say no to other things. And that's what to decide means, to discern, to cut. So when I say I'm going to do the Ironman, I know that means I'm not going to have as much of a social life. I'm going to do fewer hours at work, so I'm not going to earn as much, but I am going to do an Ironman. So that's the balance. And I think that's a challenge that we don't often make a conscious decision of what we really, really want to do.
That leads me to ask a question that this is just based on experiences that I've had in my life. But so you can make that decision, you can be conscious about it, and you can be able to explain it clearly and have people around you who just can't accept it. Which is when you talk about, I won't have as much time for work, you left work to train, things like that. I mean, I found, an example of, let's take something like you want to change your life. You decide I'm going to start working out and I'm going to start eating in a healthy way. And we often, often that not going to the gym after 2 weeks thing is, is a very, popular story. Everyone knows it. Lots of gyms make lots of money off that. But one thing I've discovered or found in my life is that often the biggest obstacle is the people closest to you, because they don't want you to change. And they haven't made that decision. They haven't made that cut in their life. And often they'll be, and they're like, it can take various forms that we're all familiar with, right? Like, oh, why don't you just treat yourself and not go to the gym today? And it's like, well, if you've made that decision, that's not treating yourself is going to the gym and doing it. Treating yourself is following your new nutritional scheme, and so do you have any advice about that? I mean, having done something so intense, like the Ironman and like you did, do you have any advice for people who run into that pressure?
It's you choose the people around you. And you become the average of those around you. There is some evidence, I can't cite it, but there is research that if all of your social group tend to be overweight, you're more likely to be overweight. And yes, when I first came to New Zealand, I was flatting with a group of other 20-somethings, early 30s, it was like friends, and they were all party animals and they were going out all the time. And I would go for a drink with them now and again, but sometimes I'd say, well, I'm doing a marathon the following morning. And they would actually sneer at me a bit and say, oh, he's a bit of an achiever. And I'll say, well, actually, yeah, I'm not, I'm doing my Open University degree at night. I'm doing the marathon in the morning. I'm not going on out on town with you. So there is that peer pressure, and I had to be who I am, right? You don't become popular by doing this, and it actually goes against your nature to not conform with the people around you. So choose the people around you is the thing I would say. If you pick a group of people who are runners, you will tend to become a runner. And it's happening for me this week. So my coach, I'm a health coach, my coach Grant and Louise, they are doing a 5-day fast this week. They do it every year. And Grant has just written a book, Choose Your Hard. And I did a book swap with
That's a
him last
great
week.
title.
And it is, I mean, life is hard, but you get to choose, is it the short-term hard or the long-term hard? And he's a professor in metabolic health. He's quite famous here in New Zealand. But I'm doing the 5-day fast as well. I thought, well, I'll join in, and I know some of the other health coaches are doing the same thing. Now, today and yesterday, quite easy because my wife isn't here, so I've just kind of locked the fridge and I'm just on water. It's great. But my wife is working away and she's back tonight. But she's already agreed that she's going to do a 1-day fast with me tomorrow. because it would be really hard for her to be frying bacon or something when I'm really hungry. So that's the point, is you have to, and James Clear talks about this, you create the systems that then create the habits. Habits are systems. So you create a decision architecture that the least friction path is what you want to do. So I will have my, if I'm going to go for a swim or a run in the morning, I will have my running gear or my swim bag ready. So when I get out of bed, I'm just good to go. No friction. But yeah, that's one of the challenges we face, is that the world and the environment gets in our way.
Yeah, and of course can include the people, and you need to have people who you don't need to explain yourself to or justify yourself to. If you've made this decision, hopefully you can do it just once, maybe twice, and be convincing enough. But it's interesting that often, yeah, we talk about our habits and routines and productivity and don't think about the people around us so much. So the second part is governing intent, the second part of the book. Can you talk a little bit about that idea?
And this is going to lead to a future book I'm writing on organizational intent, but for personal mastery, this is just personal mastery. So you've made the decision. I'm going to go to the gym, or I'm going to fast, or I'm going to do an Ironman, or anything. It could, learn the guitar. But then when you've made that decision, you need to govern your future self. So what are you going to do when it gets hard? What's the deliberate practice, firstly, that you're going to take yourself on this journey? What's the first move, that bias to action, that activation energy? And then when you're in that zone of persisting, when it gets hard and it's tough, and deliberate practice isn't easy, it's frustrating. Karate is one example of that. Is what are you going to say to yourself, and how are you going to mentally manage that? Because when you're in the middle of it, that's the worst time for you to make that decision. The worst time for me to make the decision on the floor in Kona, in the Ironman, was should I continue or should I stop? I should have said to myself, if I collapse, I'm out. But in the moment, I made that decision to carry on. So what we want to do is govern our future self. And I think self-governance is not, it's not that we don't have good intentions, or we know what's good for us. We all, mostly, we know what is healthy and good and professional to do. But the reason we quit, and the reason we don't follow things through, or perhaps we overreach or we drift, is because we're not governing ourselves. So that's a proposal I've got, and that's the essence. I think that's the innovation within the book. I use the metaphor of the central governor model by Tim Noakes, which is that the mind will switch off the body before the body becomes dangerous. And so you need to moderate what that central governor does.
And how do you suggest someone go about, say, they take on a project like, they're going to learn a martial art or something like that? Let just to pick a specific example, if they were then sort of going through the governing intent kind of planning process, what scenarios would they put themselves through? What would they do? Do they have a journal, things like that?
So writing it down, journaling, really, really important. And I've got a thing here, which is my idea. It's called an issue card. And you can see that I wrote that
Yes.
on Monday, and that's fast for 5 days. The very practice of writing down what your intent is, and then saying what your first move is, and what you're going to govern when you need to persist. And then also trigger mechanisms for you to exit, to abort, or what are you going to do when you know it's uncomfortable? What are your strategies to persist? But also, finally, ask your future self the question that your future self will ask you. Right? That's a lot to think about. So you preempt the questions at the end, because if you ask the questions at the end, they're going to be biased by the outcome. So the outcome is important, but the decision quality is more important. And so it's called resulting. That a good outcome doesn't necessarily mean it was a good decision, and vice versa. And Annie Duke talks about this in Decision Making. It's a great book. So what I do, and there's a governance artifact called the issue card. And what you do is you write down your issue. So the time horizon, is this just for a day? Is this 90 minutes of deep work? Is it a week or 5 days for my fast? Or it could be a long arc issue. So I've got a long arc issue. I'm doing Ironman New Zealand again next March. So I'm already training for that. That'll be my 10th on that course. So I get in the Hall of Fame. But within that, there's certain trigger points. And I'm not just thinking of that long horizon. Every week I've got a goal for the training for the week, and I break it down into 12-week blocks. And then at each 12-week block, I'll maybe have a rest or a race or something. And then within the week, I'll have a daily issue. So today, for example, I'm going to be on my Zwift. I'm going to indoor cycle later this afternoon. And that cycle will be 90 minutes. And so then I'll have a purpose of what I'm trying to do today. Well, because I'm fasted, it's just going to be zone two, nice and easy, nothing too tense. So you set your intent and you're very specific about it, and then you write it down. And I keep repeating that because there is some research from the National Health Service in the UK that when people were given an empty appointment card and actually wrote it down, the number of no-shows statistically significantly dropped by 18%. So the actual thing of writing your own appointment card rather than being given a pre-written appointment card means you're going to remember that appointment more likely. So really important. It's like an intent card, but I've added to it the deliberate practice, the persistence, and then the reflection.
The third part of the book is the issue spiral, and we've been using this word a little bit already. So before we go on to, so let now we're here we are talking about the issue spiral. And so can you please just begin by letting us know what the word means?
Okay, so you'll see this here, this calligraphy kanji just there.
Very beautiful, yeah.
Kindly drawn up by a calligrapher in Japan, a renowned calligrapher, Inoue Shunbo, and throughout my book is his works, and they all have meaning within the book, each section. So the issue spiral. Firstly, what does ishi mean? Well, ishi in Japanese is translated as determined intent, and you'll see that there's two kanji. The one on the left is that inner resonance of what's in your heart, what you really want to do. And then the bottom part is kokoro, which is heart mind. And then on the right hand side is a scholar or warrior or samurai, and it's the action. So in my to anglicize it a little bit, I would say that it's thought that leads to action, action that is thoughtful. And I think it's great to have thoughts, but if there's no action, you're just going to be sat there. And we need a bias to action, but it needs to be driven by intent. So I think they pair well beautifully. And then you'll see the spiral as well. This is my idea. It's kind of based on the Enzo in Japanese Zen Buddhism, the drawing of the paint. And so the calligrapher interpreted my thinking by creating a spiral, which is a sequence of Enzo all the way down. And so it's not a loop. I don't the issue spiral is not a loop, because when you return to the beginning, you're not in the same place. You've grown, the conditions have changed, you've learned things. So I think you're progressing either upwards or downwards. I can't decide. And so within the issue spiral, I see that there's four problems that I think that we as a society we're facing. Firstly is the decision hygiene and how we make the decisions and if we make them for ourselves. The second is how we perform deliberate practice. Sometimes we just get into things and we forget our helmets in transition. Not that Lucy didn't do deliberate practice, she did, but that's just an example. I think we fail to persist. We sometimes quit too soon because we don't have a good reason for that decision. It's much easier to carry on if you know why you're doing it and if that decision's been written down and it's explicit. Or worse, we carry on too long, like I did with my startup, because I was just too stubborn. I wasn't going to give up and I kept going, and that becomes dangerous. And then finally, I don't think we effectively reflect because we're all subject to cognitive biases, confirmation bias, escalation of commitments, sunk cost. And so I think we need a mechanism to effectively reflect so we can make better decisions next time. But these aren't, I don't believe these are four independent failure modes. I see it as a system. So when you deliberate practice, you need to persist. When you persist, you need a decision. When you decide, you need good reflection. And when you reflect, you need to learn from the deliberate practice. So they all intertwine. So it's not a sequence phase of all four things, but the sequence is when you govern. Are you governing the decision, the practice, the persistence, or the reflection? So that's the ishi spiral, and it comprises of four phases: decide, forge, persist, reflect. And I've used four Japanese words for this, which is ishi, shugyo, gaman, and hansei.
And do you have specific recommendations for the reflection step? That's the one that I think particularly I find interesting. Like,
Yeah,
do you write
so
down? Do you talk to someone?
journaling, of course, and that's certainly part of it. So David Marquet, who I work with, he's the ex-submarine commander, also ex-US Navy. And he wrote the book Turn the Ship Around, which was all intent-based leadership. And that's when I really got hooked into his work. And then he wrote Leadership is Language, which is how what we say can influence others, and how we speak to ourselves actually can influence how we think. But his third book is really, really useful, and it's called Distancing. And he co-authored it with Professor Mike Gillespie of Florida University. And psychological distancing is where you try and get out of yourself, out of your own ego. And you ask yourself, well, what would somebody else do? So that's what the founders of Intel did when they shifted from processors to memory chips. And they said to themselves, well, if we were all fired today and then hired again back tomorrow, what would we do as new CEO? And Grove said, well, of course, we would take up memory chips. So you think like somebody else, you think like some time else, and that's why in the decision phase you're governing your future self, but in the hansei phase you want to ask your previous self what the decision was. So you're kind of reporting to you're governing your future self. So my space, my the different person, different place, different time. Different place is you imagine looking down on yourself onto the dance floor. What do you see? And you kind of extract out, because with our egos, we try and reinforce what we already believe. We don't seek with curiosity what actually is the case. So in my book, I've got a few techniques and tools with how to perform a hansei. And hansei actually comes from the Toyota production system. It's used there as a reflection. And there's some really good writing on that by Jeffrey Leiker and Katie Anderson, actually, in particular, on learning to lead, leading to learn. And how Toyota use hansei as a technique to learn from what we've actually created.
And in the fourth part of the book, Ishii in Real Life, you talk about when the spiral breaks. And I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about that.
So it is not an organizational book. That's my next book. But for this, I used real case studies. There's six of them. And what I wanted to do, because when there's an organizational failure, you can then, sometimes victories, we don't know the cause, but whenever there's a failure, we can always find out what the cause was. So I looked at six different cases. So American Apparel, so Ryan Holiday talks about that, where Dov Cheney, the CEO, basically just burned himself out. He was available to his team 24/7 around the world, and he made poor decisions because he was ultimately burning out. Kodak, great performance, great quality systems, but they didn't reflect and they didn't refine their decisions, so they carried on down one path. And then Bonza Aviation, that's an Australian company who went out too fast without the deliberate practice, and they were bankrupt within a year or two. And then two naval stories. HMS Artemis, which in the UK Submarine Service, we learn about this, was a sub that sank in 1971, just before I was born. And it wasn't one major catastrophe. It was a sequence of lots of small things, like hatches being left open, the trims not being monitored, cables forcing the hatches to stay open and things. And it was in dock in Gosport, in view of the escape tower training. So when you're a submariner, you have to train to learn how to escape from a sunken sub. And there's this tower in Gosport in the naval base. Right next to it was a sub, and it just sank in off its moorings. And so the Navy lost it. And this was during the height of the Cold War, very embarrassing. But it turned out it was lots of small things that happened. So as a bridge watch keeper now, it's mandatory reading in the Royal Navy that you have to read the reports of why it happened. And it was lots of little tiny things that happened that caused the ship to sink. And then finally, a New Zealand ship that sank 2 years ago, HMNZS Manawanui. And I've looked at the transcript from the bridge. and the official report is out. I'm probably it's probably too soon, actually. In retrospect, it was already out, and because the captain has now just been court-martialed, so it's a current event. So I'm not making any judgment on the outcome of that, or anything else, other than there were certain aspects of it which demonstrated a lack of deliberate practice. So when they abandoned ship, so they basically they left it in autopilot, and didn't realize it was still in autopilot, and tried to push it astern, and it didn't, and it kind of hit a reef in Samoa, and sank, and caused a bit of an ecological disaster. But then through the transcripts is you could see things like the life rafts. Nobody knew how to tie the right t tow and tie the life rafts. It's a minor detail again. When the ship's sinking, that's not the time to learn about those things. And the people on the bridge weren't qualified and hadn't practiced some of the sequences that they were doing. So that goes completely opposite to what I said about the Navy, where we do all of that practicing. Apparently, on the Manawanui, they didn't. So, and it's not to point fingers at individuals, it's to look at systemic failure. And in each case, I can identify it's an absence of one of those four, or one or several of those four phases of the issue spiral.
Yeah, that's I mean, those are such great examples. And I love the way that your book is grounded in these, like, sort of stories, like it begins with, and then, these examples from real life and things like that, but also sort of very practical things, like here's an ishi card, like write this down, stuff like that, grounded in actual practice, which is really amazing. It's interesting too that I hadn't thought about so much about the kind of discipline and kind of naval examples, or sort of basically military ones. You reminded me of there was a kind of relatively kind of well-known story at the beginning of the Russian war against Ukraine, where there were images coming up because everything's on social media nowadays of like Russian military vehicles where the tires hadn't been rotated, and if you didn't take care of the tires, every 6 weeks or something like that, then when you needed to use them, that they would break down relatively quickly and wouldn't function properly. But if you're a soldier, it's kind of like, ah. You can just see all the pressure, like that'll be fine, it'll be fine, we're not going to war anyway, all that kind of stuff. And you need to have some guiding kind of reason to do it, like, no, like, this whole machine that I'm here to use and will be relying on won't be operable unless I just stick to this plan, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's exactly what I learned on HMS Beaver in the Adriatic during it was in theatre. So it was during the Yugoslav wars. Is all of our equipment had to be ready at a moment's notice. So we had loaded missile launchers in case a Serbian Soviet missile happened to launch at us that we could defend it. And it was, I mean, the software on the system what you loaded with paper tape, right? It was 1970s technology, 60s technology. But and so sometimes it would be a bit flaky, but we would have to do daily, hourly, weekly, monthly maintenance cycles, and we would have to check. And so that was basically most of my work as a maintenance engineer was just doing daily checks, daily logs, swapping things out, re-greasing things. So when you really, really need it, nothing broke down. You absolutely couldn't have anything fail. And if I'm honest, this is a distinction I've noticed from my military career with the tech sector I now work in that it's okay for you to dabble, and if it doesn't work, send out another patch and all that kind of stuff. And I think so my brother was on submarines both in the Afghanistan and the both Iraq wars, actually. And so he, if I'm not mistaken, he would have been on one or two of the subs that launched the first salvo of Tomahawks over the British and Americans that was firing them off. So when Blair and Bush gave those commands over to the sub had to launch there and then. They couldn't say, "Oh, sorry, can you send that again?"
Right.
It just happened. And so he would have been absolutely trained inside out for the comm system and for all of the weapon system on that boat to be able to perform that action. Because nations fall if that doesn't happen. But we in the tech sector have become somewhat casual to that's okay. If it's not right, we can send a patch.
So I could that I could talk about that subject for a long time. It's like, with anybody who's ever used LeanPub, I'm sorry for everything that ever went wrong. That is something that I've seen and I've talked with people about on the podcast before, is like an ex the example that I like to use is in Gmail, they hide the email address that you're sending it to or that you've received the email from. And you can click to see it. But you kind of have to do that. It's hidden from you normally. And what I always like to say is, if you ever had a job where you could go to prison for sending the wrong an email to the wrong person, you would never design an email system that way. And another example is, or perhaps a more pointed one, is there's a payment service that I won't name that a few years ago on the sort of like payment page introduced circle faces. Who would you like to pay next, kind of thing. And it's like, you don't send money to a circle face. You send money to an account, and that account has like an email address. And no one who's ever been in a position where if they sent that $50 to the wrong email address, their grandma, they didn't have another $50 to send to grandma to come visit on the bus for Christmas. Nobody who'd ever been in that situation would have ever designed a payment system based on like delight, or fun. And there's definitely something in that, and I won't be the first person to have complained about this, but you can definitely see the kind of backgrounds of the people in the tech sector in the products that they designed, not an original or observation, but it's 100% the case that if everybody comes from, if everybody's come from an upper middle class background and gone to Stanford and then, gone straight from there to a kind of six figure salary, did that background's going to be baked into the way they design things.
And so it's not a criticism of the people,
No,
absolutely.
no.
But I fully agree. And it's a challenge we face because we obviously, the flip side is you don't want kind of military development cycles, right?
No,
1970
absolutely
software.
not. No,
So there's
exactly. Yeah.
obviously a trade. There is
Yeah.
a trade-off.
Yeah.
But I would like to, and this is what I've tried to do in New Zealand, is with the tech companies I've consulted at, is tend towards more discipline and more deliberate practice. Not because I'm an authoritarian, but because I know if you can't attend to the small things, then the big things start to unravel. There's a balancing act. It's not polarity, but I think we if we're not careful, we will drift towards the she'll be right kind of attitude, and I just want to encourage the industry not to do that as much.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Going from weapons and war to books, in the last part of the interview, I always like to ask authors about their writing process and stuff like that. And you wrote to me before the interview saying that, the book itself was an example of an issue. And that then that your approach to it was structured, and probably the book changed based on your experience, right? What you plan to do changed on your experience writing it. So what was your approach to writing the book?
So yeah, it all started about 10 years ago. I was an agile coach. I started talking. I was delivering training courses, so I love being on stage. And I started talking at meetups, and somebody said, "Well, you probably have a book with your Iron Man world and your agile world. Blend them together. You've got a good story to tell." And of course, the Japanese philosophy, which we haven't talked about much today, but I'm really fascinated with. And so I said to myself, "Yeah, I'm going to write a book." And a lot of people say that, and I know there's lots of people who may be watching this are thinking, "Yeah, I could really write a book. I've got this great book idea, and I want to write it." So that was, I left Visa at the end of 2019, and I thought, well, I'll start the book in 2020, then I'll do the Iron Man in the end of 20, then I'll have it published in 21 or something like that. But then COVID happened and everything was disrupted. And it took me a few years, but I had that commitment, and I would tell anybody, yes, I'm writing a book, it's going to be on Iron Man, and I've got these other books as well, and I think I've got something to say. And it's because I just want to do it. That was the first thing. I set myself initially an intent. One day I'll write a book. And 2 years ago, or two to 3 years ago, I started to feel a bit ashamed that I keep telling these people I'm going to write a book. Where is it? Kind of thing. And so some people say, don't talk about it, just do it. I think Ryan Holiday says that, be the stoic, just do it, don't talk about it. But I think there's also merit in what I do is I will declare, publicly, I'm going to do this race. I'm going to do a double Kiwi Man or whatever, because that then I'm committed to it. It's part of my identity. It's in me. So I remember. So I left Visa at Christmas 2019, and in January 2020, I said, right, okay, let's get into this. And I logged into LeanPub. I'd heard about LeanPub probably 5 years prior, and immediately I thought, this is great. This is incremental and iterative. Get out what you've got. Force yourself to repeat and go through the practice. And it's a low friction, low barrier to entry to become a published author. So I knew I wanted to publish on LeanPub. And so 2020, I signed up to it, started with gusto, then things changed. And I was writing articles. I think it was 2021. It was. So I promised myself in 2021 I would write 1,000 words a day and publish it in blogs, on the Tri Club, on LinkedIn, everywhere. Just 1,000 words a day. Any old crap, doesn't matter, just write it. And I did quite well. Got to the Kiwi Man double in 2021, got into a big engagement that kind of tailed off. But I was still quite prolific writing articles on LinkedIn. And then about a year ago, because I was working with David Marquet, I was just finding that he seems to land the speaking gigs. And when I was on a stage with David, we could fill a room together. It was great. But then when I would say, hey, I want to talk about intent-based leadership, I'm over in Sydney, no one would turn up. So I thought, well, it's not me. I kind of know. Well, it is me, actually. It's not David. It's because he's the author and he's got a great story to tell. And, I enjoy talking about it as well. So I spoke to the CEO of this company, Intent-Based Leadership International, a year ago and said, that's it. What I need to do is just get this book finished. So I dropped a client. I had a cybersecurity client last year. I said, look, I'm going to wrap this up. I was racing last year and I pulled one big race. I still did the World Champs in Sydney, which was a week that I kind of did the race, but it wasn't really a serious race. It was a week in a camper van with a laptop, just churning out the words. So that was in October. And that's when I finished the first cut of the manuscript. But I'd set myself, I'm going to get this book done and dusted, because now I've got the book, it gives me the opportunity to, frankly, to do things like this. I love talking about it. I don't know if you can tell.
Oh, sure.
And go on stage, talk about it, share these ideas, because when you're with a client, they don't have time for you to sit down and say, hey, now here's the theory. That's the book reference. This is what I've tried. Why don't we try this? They just kind of fix it for me. So this is what I really, really want to do. So my wife was really supportive. She said, okay, there's not much work going on in New Zealand. Sit down and write your book. So that's kind of what I've done for the last 12 months, starting with daily on LinkedIn, just posting Kaizen of the day, just a little small improvement. And that's now turned into a book of 100 Kaizens, which I've recently published on LeanPub. And the next version's out later this week. Then it's off to the editor, and then it'll be paperback. And also my main book, which is Issue the Discipline of Determined Intent, which I launched on LeanPub on the 6th of January 2026. That happens to be the second Friday in January, Quitter's Day. So that's why I launched that. And then there's a third book, which is the Issue Guide, which is a 24-page issue explanation of the issue spiral, which is an appendix in the main book. But I got that out late December. So, and that was a great learning journey for me. So I had to persist with the writing. I did little and often every day. I set myself a target every morning. I would post the Kaizen of the day, 8 a.m. New Zealand time, 500 words, just nice and easy, and then just prolifically write. So that's that deliberate practice, get better by through the practice and get the feedback and persist and then gain feedback. So then this is where I think LeanPub is a publisher's issue spiral. So you make the decision to do it little and often. I then got into the cycle earlier this year of every few weeks updating the book, every 2 weeks. Now, the feedback from some of the people saying, that's great, but every time I started the book, you'd change it. So I've learned that now. So for future books, I'm not going to be quite as prolific. But what it taught me was, I struggled. So I started with your older UI. I think you refreshed it December last year. So I'm not, unbeknownst to me, I published the day before you went down for 2 days. So I thought, phew, at least I got it in before Christmas. But learning how to use Scrivener, how to export the Markdown files, how there's some adjustments you need to make. I had a problem with LaTeX and kanji symbols in PDF files, and I actually used AI a lot to support me in this. And I was by myself, and I just learned. I taught myself, but having the I'm publishing this Friday, one way or another, meant for the first time in my life, well, at least since the Open University, I would sit at my desk 8 hours, deep work, and focus on getting the book published. So I really enjoyed the process of having LeanPub be my self-imposed target that this week I'm going to version 0.9 is going to be out, and it succeeded all the way through to end of March, and now it's ISBN, it's fully published, it's got David Mackay's foreword, and it's there. So and my Kaizen of the day is the next book off the rank, and then Ishii for businesses, and it's probably 5 or 10 books. This is what I'm going to do now for the next few years.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for sharing that great story. My apologies. Well, I mean, I'm glad you got it done just before we launched our big V3 launch in December. Yeah, that was I'm sorry that it was right around that time that happened. But
This is exciting. No need to apologize, mate.
okay, yeah, but that is such a great story, and you know, it is definitely true that one of the things we try and say about, like, the kind of, you can publish books on LeanPub that are completely finished, you know, you can do it however you like, but one of the things about being able to update a book and publishing it in progress is that, you know, you can there's this motivation to do the next one and the next one and the next one, and if you have readers, they love it, like, oh, there's a new issue out, there's a new version out, you know, with a new chapter or changes and stuff like that. People will sometimes, it takes a little getting used to that, like, it's not just additive. Something I read in the past might actually change as well. But people do typically get used to that over time. The last question I always have, if the guest is a LeanPub author on the podcast, is if there was any magical feature we could build for you that you could ask us to build for you, or if there was anything that had you, other than our big redesign launch, shaking your fist at LeanPub, going, "Damn you, LeanPub! Why does this cause me so much pain? Why can't you fix this?" That you could ask us to fix. Is there anything that you can think of that you would ask us to do?
That's put me on the spot.
Yeah,
So
sometimes.
I'll because I'm selling books now, I've started to have online payment platforms, and I'm setting up a website and all that kind of stuff, and that's all new to me. But I'll name names. So I use Grok, ChatGPT, and Claude. Claude is my main platform of choice, and ChatGPT kind of prompts Claude, and Claude has an MCP into Stripe. So I don't know. I struggle with setting up Stripe, and Eventbrite is terrible. If they've got an MCP, I'm going to find out. But now I just go to Claude and say, okay, give me a QR code for selling the book in Singapore dollars. That's my next thing because I'm speaking in Singapore in a few weeks.
Okay.
And it will just do it for me. I think there is a benefit to being able to pop the bonnet and have a look underneath. But if I were to be able to, when I get to the point of publishing or making changes, if I could have a direct Claude MCP interface with LeanPub, that would make my life easier. Because what I was doing, I was using ChatGPT when I first published, is I'd take a screenshot on both Scrivener actually and LeanPub, and I'll say, this is what's happened, this is the error code, what am I doing? And it would say, oh, you check this or select that. But having the, I mean, I'm asking for a lot there, mate. I don't know how hard that would
Well, it's
be.
very interesting. So I'm just checking. Actually, I feel bad. I hadn't checked before. Your book is in our upload writing mode. So on that note, we do have a Claude skill that we developed on our own called Ghost AI, and you
Right.
can actually hook Claude code up to LeanPub, if you want to,
I will try it. Yeah, I'll give that a go.
and you can use the Ghost AI skill. We've done a couple of kind of we're getting into doing what we call events, kind of grandly LeanPub events, and we've done a couple with Peter talking about Ghost AI and this Ghost AI skill. It's very cool. If you choose our browser writing, you can use it in different writing modes, but if you create a book in our browser writing mode, in the browser editor at the top right, you'll see a little ghost icon, and if you click on that, then you can sort of start unlocking the tools that you do have to buy some AI credits because it costs money and stuff like that. But yeah, hopefully it's worth a try. And yeah, so we're definitely thinking about, you know, not specifically what you said, like hooking up a Claude MCP to LeanPub in some specific way. Maybe we'll do that. But we are 100% interested in that kind of thing, you know, particularly, yeah, for example, if I can be writing my book on LeanPub and my Ghost AI skill can like know all my files, all my research files on my computer, if it can know all of my pictures, yeah, you know, stuff like yeah, that. So we're definitely 100% behind that kind of thing.
I think so my upload mode was generally using Dropbox, but then more recently now, and especially because I've got the typesetter with the right fonts, and that's especially for the PDF, I'm just going to upload the PDF and EPUB, which are generated from Claude. But I will look into that Claude Ghost, especially for the newer books.
Oh, cool, cool. And one last thing I'll mention too. And by the way, the funny thing about leaving this section about writing and being a writer and like, you know, promoting your book to the end is there are people who skip all the front part and they jump to this part because they want to hear about this kind of stuff. So I've heard that from people before. And one thing I will mention is relatively recently, we actually added QR code generation to our coupons feature. So if you create a coupon on LeanPub for your book, like a discount coupon link, you can actually just create a QR code. You can get a QR code right from there. So those are like kind of, it's funny. There's some people who are like, oh, QR codes. They're very useful, by the way.
they are. So when I do a keynote, I have QR codes on my Substack and things like that. But what I've been doing in the last few keynotes is saying you can buy issue on LeanPub or wherever, but also Kaizen of the Day is only on LeanPub. And I will give you a link and you can grab it for free. But if there's a QR code, and you'll see all the phones go up straight away and people start scanning it.
Yes, so, people love it. It's so fun. And that's why we added it to the discount coupon as well. Like, you got to get a picture now, you know, get your discount for the book. So it's very cool. So Gareth, thank you very much for taking the time to do this really fun podcast episode with me today. The book is Ishii, The Discipline of Determined Intent. Hopefully we'll do another one of these or maybe some more launch videos and get to talk a little bit more Japanese philosophy in the future. But I think we covered some really good ground here, and I was really glad to talk to you about this really great book today.
Thank you, Len. I really appreciate it. Cheers.